Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Book. Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Today's interview is with Karen Neander, Professor of Philosophy at Duke University. Her new book, A Mark of the Mental, In Defense of Informational Teleosemantics, is just out from the MIT Press. The two biggest problems of understanding the mind are consciousness and intentionality, the latter being the problem of how we can have thoughts and perceptions that are about other things. For example, a thought about a tree that you saw when you walked down the street, or a perception of a tree. Intentionality is difficult to understand, not least because we're able to have thoughts or perceptions about things that don't exist, like unicorns, or anything in the future, for that matter. A naturalistic theory of aboutness or intentionality will be an account of this feature of the mind that involves only those elements that can be found in nature, like causal relationships or evolution. In her new book, Neander synthesizes a number of these elements, including causal relationships, a particular view of evolutionary functions, and an account of second-order similarity, which is similarity relationships, to provide a causal informational version of teleosemantics that explains the content of sensory perceptual states. For example, the content of a toad's perception when it perceives what we would call a fly. On her view, the content of a perceptual state is what is supposed to cause it, in the sense that it is what that state is adapted to respond to. She articulates differences between her account and other versions of teleosemantics, and she puts her theory to work in responses to a series of problems that have been raised for teleosemantic theories. This is a well-written, clearly argued book by one of the leading figures in contemporary philosophy of mind, particularly those working on the problem of intentionality. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Karen Neander. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Hello, Carrie. Thank you for inviting me.
It's my pleasure to be talking to one of the leading theorists about naturalistic semantics, and the new book, as I've described, is a synthesis of a lot of work over the past few decades, to which you have been a major contributor. And I like one of the sentences that you have in the book that kind of very nicely encapsulates in simple form what you're doing, is this idea that a sensory perceptual representation refers to what is supposed to cause it. And what's interesting about that sentence is that the only word perhaps of it that doesn't have a lot of work behind it is the word the rest of it all involves a lot of very detailed and interesting work that you talk about sort of throughout the book. But before we get to talking about your view of naturalized semantics, can you just give a little background about how you came to philosophy and to the topics that you're interested in and to the writing of this book?
Yeah. So I don't feel that I have a terribly interesting story to tell about how I came to philosophy. As an undergraduate, I really didn't know what philosophy was. And I sampled it and immediately felt at home with it. I mean, I remember in high school occasionally asking teachers what are, in retrospect, philosophical questions and getting very embarrassed responses, I'd say, and being told by my friends that I thought too much. And, you know, you go into a philosophy class and all of a sudden here are these people who are encouraging you to think very hard about these deep and difficult and awkward questions. And so I just, you know, loved it. And I've always been interested in philosophy of mind. I know, you know, if you look back at my research papers and so on, it seems as though I've been working in philosophy of biology a lot of the time. But right from the start, the philosophy of biology I did was always motivated by an interest in philosophy of mind. And so as an undergraduate, I was interested in free will and moral responsibility and started my dissertation on the notion of mental illness and the relevance of insanity to moral responsibility. And that morphed into a discussion of whether illness in relation to the mind was the same kind of thing as illness in relation to the body, and the nature of biological explanations and psychological explanations, and this concept of function and dysfunction and how they applied in the biological, straightforwardly biological context, and how they might apply in relation to the mind. So this was in around 1980. I was working on functions, and it was early days as far as teleosemantics was concerned. So Dennis Stamp had written something on teleosemantics, and a few other people had written a little bit. But mostly in philosophy of mind, it was toward the end of the heyday of what now sometimes gets called classical functionalism. And so I think the first paper I ever heard on teleosemantics was given by Kim Sterelny. And I was immediately fascinated by this idea that this notion of function and dysfunction that I'd been working on in relation to this question about mental illness, whether it had a more wide application to issues in philosophy of mind. And so this book is really an extension of that. It's an interest in intentionality, which I think is, if not the most fundamental aspect of the mind, is certainly one of the most fundamental aspects of the mind. And to my way of thinking, it might be the most important aspect of the mind in the sort of the deepest sense. I think it's what allows for people to have purposes and make decisions and, you know, have priorities and plans and so on. So in some sense, it's a prerequisite for our mental lives to be meaningful.
One of the things that you address at the beginning of the book, is the idea that consciousness is the hard problem. This is like the second hardest problem. So there's a sort of, you know, priority, who has the hardest problem? And so, I mean, do you kind of concede that, but what you just said makes me think that, you know, maybe, you know, the problem of intentionality, which we'll talk about in a second, is actually more fundamental, do you think?
Well, I don't know. I mean, of course, the title of the book comes from a slight switch around of Brentano's phrase, where he says intentionality is the mark of the mental, that which distinguishes minds from mindless matter. And I'm not sure about that. I don't feel that I understand consciousness well enough to make that claim. So I'm staying agnostic on whether you can have consciousness without intentionality. I think if it came to the choice, if you could pull them apart and I had to choose between consciousness and intentionality, I think very reluctantly I would choose intentionality. So in that sense, I think it's in some ways more important. And I think it's more tractable at the moment. I think we can make some progress on understanding the nature of intentionality. And so I felt that I could contribute to solving that problem rather than just wallow around in how difficult it was, basically. So that was why I chose it.
Okay, well, you've mentioned, you know, teleosemantics, which your theory falls under that broad umbrella, and intentionality. So maybe for our listeners who aren't quite so intimately acquainted with this problem, maybe you can explain a bit, you know, what is the problem of intentionality? I mean, and what is it to provide, or what would be the requirements for providing a naturalistic solution to it?
So I think intentionality is one of these words that people do use in somewhat different ways in philosophy of mind. But Brentano once uses the phrase, or at least he's translated as using the phrase, refers to a content when he characterizes intentionality. And what I see myself as doing in discussing it is giving a theory of reference for mental representations, or at least a class of mental representations. And but I suppose more vaguely you could say that the intentional power of a mind is its power to represent. So it's its representational power. And to give a naturalistic theory of it, you know, again, that's another of those words that people use in different ways. But when I was a child, I went to Sunday school and was given these pictures of angels looking down from the heavens. And I suppose I believed in a immortal and immaterial soul, though I'm sure I didn't express it in those words at the time. And when I gave up that picture of the mind, I remained fascinated, or became fascinated, with the broad question of how to understand various aspects of our mental lives within a more scientific picture. And so basically, to give a naturalistic theory of intentionality is to try to do that, and to succeed in doing that, of course. If it's naturalistic, it won't invoke anything mystical or magical or miraculous. It will try to stick within the scientific picture of the world. And of course, we don't have just one scientific picture of the world. There are competing approaches within cognitive science and neuroscience and so on to how you go about studying the mind. But it's sort of adopting a respect for science and trying to give a theory of intentionality in a way that is kind of respectful to the science, the best science we have in your view of the mind.
You know, again, this is somewhat preliminary, but also kind of lays the groundwork for your eventual theory. This tie with the sciences, and cognitive science in particular, you give what you call a methodological argument for, you know, why this problem of intentionality, of explaining how it is that, you know, we can have thoughts or states that are about other things. That this is a real problem. That, in other words, that cognitive scientists actually do posit states, representations, in their explanations. And the opponent here obviously are those people who also look at the science, you know, at cognitive science, and argue that actually, this is kind of a pseudo problem because the cognitive scientists, again, don't need any sorts of representational states in order to do the explanatory work that they that they're doing or that they want to do. So, could you just give us a flavor of how you respond to those people and defend the idea that, no, this is actually looking at the cognitive science as it is done. The problem of intentionality is a genuine problem, you know, even within the sciences as we know them now.
Yeah, so this takes like three chapters in the book, but just to try to give the flavor of it, I don't try to address the anti-representationalists head on. I just say, look, here is this useful cognitive science. People are explicitly talking about representations. And it's not just talk about information processing, it's talk about representations in the sense that they're positing representational states that can be erroneous. They can misrepresent, and they indeed, you know, investigate cases where there is misrepresentation in order to try to understand what the structure of the representational states is and what the processes are that are contributing to the creation of these representations. So they, you know, many of them just do very explicitly talk this way, and even neuroscience is fairly replete with talk of representation. And I don't think it's something they should feel defensive about. I think that it's a useful way of talking, and I think it comes out of mainly two things. I think it comes out of, first off, a sort of general background idealization that goes on. When you do any kind of physiology or neurophysiology, you're trying to give not just a description of a single system, but of, you're trying to give useful descriptions, some of the time at least, you're trying to give useful descriptions of types of systems. You're trying to get some generality. And to do that, you start describing, or what they do is they describe the way systems operate when they're functioning normally or properly. And that's not the only thing they do. They do other things as well, of course, but that plays a fairly central role in physiology and neurophysiology. And then I think when you move into talking about how the brain's performs its information processing functions, and you add in this talk of information processing, you're now talking about information, you know, what is it in the functional sense? Is it that these brains are supposed to be doing with this information? What information are they supposed to be carrying? What are they supposed to do by way of processing it? How are they supposed to be transforming the information? And that sounds like a sort of, as if I'm using a moral term, but of course I'm not. I'm talking in terms of what is it that they do when they're functioning properly? What were they adapted to do? What were they selected to do, these various different mechanisms in the brain? And I think already as soon as you've done that, you've got the aboutness of information combined with the so-called normativity of talk of systems functioning normally or properly. And really you've got the beginnings of the talk of representation at that point. And it's, you know, I think the methodological argument for teleosemantics is to the effect that, look, you know, you've already got this. You've got the aboutness of information and you've got the so-called normativity from functions. Let's see how far you can go with this in developing a theory of reference, because reference is aboutness, and one of its you know, puzzling features is this fact that you've got this invaluable notion, you know, of representation which permits misrepresentation and which allows you to speak of correctness and incorrectness and accuracy and inaccuracy and truth and falsity and so on. Let's see how far you can go developing this idea, using this notion of function and the notion of information to get out a theory of mental representation.
And you also, so mental representation, of course, is a wide involves, you know, thoughts and, you know, propositional attitudes generally, but also the sensory perceptual states that you actually focus on. And you make note early on that you originally intended to kind of give a solution to the whole problem in a way, and you've scaled back your what you wanted to do and focused on sensory perceptual representations in particular. And so a lot of the examples that you give are like perception of a line or of a particular sound or something like that. So fairly early, you might say, perceptual representations. Can you say something about the importance of that restriction?
Yeah, I think that when people give naturalistic theories of content, they often don't use this distinction between conceptual and non-conceptual representations. It's a distinction that's played more of a role in the consciousness literature, really, than the theory of mental content literature. And so a lot of theories, not all of them, but a lot of theories are really trying to do both at once, give a theory of non-conceptual representation and a theory of conceptual representation, sort of all in one go. And this usually involves treating conceptual thought as having original intentionality. And so original intentionality is intentionality that does not derive from other independently existing intentionality. So it might derive from something, might derive from other natural phenomena, but it doesn't derive from other independently existing intentionality. And I suspect that that's a mistake, and that a lot of conceptual thought, at least, probably doesn't have original intentionality in that sense. And so we need to do the simple stuff first. So that's the, I see myself as trying to kind of build the foundations on which hopefully me, but also other people, will then try to build different kinds of structures to provide a theory of content for concepts. But more practically speaking, I got to the point where I just thought, I'm never going to be able to close this book off, because the more you get into thinking about how a theory of concepts should go, the more complicated it seems and the more issues and problems there are to be dealt with. And it felt like my one book was going to, if it was ever going to finish talking satisfactorily about concepts, it was going to turn into three books. And so I just decided, well, okay, I'm just going to stop it here. And I carved off some of the chapters I'd written already on concepts and decided to limit it to non-conceptual representations.
So you start, you know, baby steps, but not so baby. You start by giving a simple causal informational version of teleosemantics, as you put it, a theory that you call CT for short. Could you just explain perhaps the basic elements of that initial theory? I mean, you add another element to it later on in the book in response to some particular problems. But, you know, let's just start with the initial simple or relatively simple causal informational version of teleosemantics, or CT.
Yeah. So I should actually add just to what I was saying before, that I don't see myself as only talking about very early perceptual representations. I see myself in the book as trying to take myself to the brink of talking about concepts. And toward the end of chapter 8, I start talking about how you could have higher order representations cued by a number of different lower order sensory perceptual representations and how they could have different weightings and so on. So I don't think, you know, I think at that point you're dealing with more concept-like representations. So the initial simple causal informational teleosemantics, I think, is really much the same as a proposal put forward by Dennis Stamp way back in 1977, I think it was. And the idea is that, you know, it's basically a twist on a causal theory of reference. And the idea is that perceptual, sensory perceptual representations don't represent whatever causes them, but they represent what's supposed to cause them in this teleosemantic sense. That is, you consider the function of the system that produces the representation, these sensory perceptual pathways, and you consider what these pathways were adapted for responding to by producing the representational state in question. And that's the basic idea. So I think it's a fairly intuitive idea. It's just that people have dismissed the idea of combining a causal theory of reference with teleosemantics for, I think, quite wrong reasons, quite mistaken reasons, but partly because they were too ambitious, I think. I mean, I think that partly they thought, well, you can't have a causal theory of reference for a thought about tomorrow, for example. You know, tomorrow can't cause a thought about tomorrow because, you know, tomorrow is not here yet. So I think that part of it was they were being too ambitious. They were trying to get a theory to do too much at once. And partly it's ideas about the way teleosemantics was supposed to be. You know, people would say things like, if you're going to give a teleosemantic theory, you have to worry about the effects of the representation because functions are effects of things. And so part of what I'm doing in the book is making it legitimate to give a causal theory of reference that's also a teleosemantic theory by saying, look, you know, sensory perceptual systems have these response functions. They were adapted for responding in specific ways to specific environmental features. And that's something that we can take advantage of when we're trying to give a theory of content for them.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You mentioned, you know, response function. So that's a particular interpretation of the notion of function that is used in teleosemantics. And there's a number of these of concepts of function, which you know Cummins functions and so forth that you go through. We don't need to go through them, but I think what might be helpful is to maybe perhaps compare your view of this view of response functions with Millikan's version of teleosemantics. You know how she uses the notion of a you know, normal or with a capital N proper function, as opposed to the way you developed the notion of function.
Yeah. So I think Millik and I have basically the same notion of function. If you just go to the heart of what theory says, we both independently developed etiological theories of functions, which the basic idea of that is that the function of something is what it was selected for or what it was adapted for. And I think we both think, you know, there are other meanings that one could assign to the word function, but we think that this notion of function plays an important role in biology and an important role in a theory of content. So I think that that's basically the same. It is true that we say some different things, and in various places Millikan says, you know, functions are always effects, and that's why you can't have a kind of like a Dretsky-like indicator semantics version of teleosemantics, and why you can't have a causal theory of reference. It's a teleosemantic theory. And I think that that's just a mistaken understanding of really her own position on functions. I think that if you use to a basic analysis of functions, it permits response functions. It's just, so I think that's a misunderstanding. So the idea of a response function is using this same notion of function and just saying, look, all of these etiological, different standard etiological theories of function, slightly, you know, worded in slightly different ways, they all permit response functions. For a long time, I just found it puzzling that people made this claim that you couldn't do teleosemantics this way. And it took me a while to figure out why people were thinking that way. But what does differ between Millikan and I is the use to which we put it in our theory of content. And Millikan's theory has shifted over the years to some extent, but when she's being most distinctively Millikan, if you can put it that way, when her theory is most distinctive as compared to other teleosemantic theories, she is emphasizing the role of what she calls the consumer, where the consumer is the system that uses the representation to perform its proper function. That is, it used it in the past to do whatever it was that it did that contributed to that system being selected. And so it's a kind of consumer-based theory of content. And I'm proposing that, at least in the case of perceptual representations, we need to focus on the function of the perceptual system and the input conditions, you know, so it's a kind of more input-based theory that focuses on the functions of the producer rather than the consumer.
So maybe could you perhaps walk us through an example of, you know, CT at work?
Mm-hmm. So one of the examples is this much abused example of the frog or the toad. And I say abused because I think a lot of people get tired of the discussion of that kind of example. But one of the things that prompted me to write at length about the toad in this and in an earlier paper was that I was struck by the fact that people never bothered to actually read the cognitive neuroethology on it. And I thought that when you did read the cognitive neuroethology, that some of the answers people were proposing, some of the contents they were assigning to the frog or the toad's perceptual representation when it went hunting were just utterly implausible. It seemed to come out of the wild blue yonder if you looked at the information processing explanations of the recognitional capacities of the toad, for instance. And so, you know, there is this example in the literature that people talk about where they talk about a frog snapping at something that's small, dark, and moving. And the question is, what is it representing this visual target as? Is it representing it as something that's small, dark, and moving, or is it representing it as a fly, say, or is it representing it as a nutritious packet of chemicals or something of that sort. And Millikan's theory, if you apply it, actually requires that you say something like, it's a nutritious packet of chemicals. That's something that Carolyn Price says in one of her books, and I think that's right. Millikan would characterize it as something like frog food, but it sort of comes, you know, that's shorthand for something nutritious. And I think when you look at the cognitive neuroethology and look at, you know, what information is being extracted, and you look at the principles that people use when they're doing an information processing style explanation of the process, they're using various principles like visible properties have to be represented before invisible properties are. And so I think that Millikan's theory, I think, is not friendly to information processing explanations of perception. And I think she has sort of more Gibsonian leanings. I don't think this is an accident. I think that people are coming to this debate about what's going on in the frog with quite different methodological assumptions, you know, about how to do theories of perception. And so I'm trying to be very explicit that I'm trying to be friendly to information processing explanations of it. And if you apply CT, you have to take into account the causal sensitivities of the frog when its perceptual system is operating normally, and it's causally sensitive to things like in the case of the toad, that I discussed the toad in detail rather than the frog. In the case of the toad, what it's sensitive to, what its visual system is sensitive to, is differences in the size and the shape and the motion relative to shape of the stimulus. And from there, it just goes straight to its, you know, it does a little bit of extra processing in terms of motor coordination and depth perception and more precise localization and so on. But after that, it goes straight to its motor system. It's not like it goes to some conceptual repertoire and thinks about food. You know, it's just picking up a certain size, shape, motion, which, you know, I for shorthand, I say worm-like motion, but it doesn't need to be a worm. Anything that's, you know, of a certain shape, preferably elongated, not too big, depending on what kind of species of toad it is, and moving in the direction of its longest axis, that's what it's preferentially responding to. And so CT gives you that result. It says, you know, what is it causally responding to? What are its causal sensitivities? Look at those. And look at what it was adapted to respond to. So if it isn't responding to it at all, as in the case of nutritional properties of the stimulus, then it's just ruled out on that ground. But if it is responding to those causal features, such as size, shape, and motion, then those are candidate content properties.
Okay, well, you mentioned Gibson and... So let me just ask a question, a follow up question on that. So you know, famously, he argued, at least fairly crudely, in my words, that what we perceive in perception are affordances, right? You know, ways in which things can be, you know, that I can use something. For example, I perceive a chair as you know, sittable, or in some sense, you know, way that I'm going to use it. And of course, he was also, you know, very obviously intensely interested in perception and what we perceive. Do you think affordances are among the hidden properties then that we don't, you know, that the visual system is not attuned to?
I don't know that I'd want to quite put it like that. I think that nutritional properties of the visual stimulus for the toad are certainly hidden, and I think that that's what Millikan's theory of content actually gives you rather than the affordance, even though she has Gibsonian sympathies and is developing a kind of more Gibsonian notion of information more recently. You know, I think that obviously the size of something is relevant to its graspability, and we can perceive its size. I think that things like its size that we perceive are relevant to its affordance, and that the brain figures out you know, whether it's graspable and so on the basis of those. So I don't, you know, I think that affordances are a little bit further along. I mean, in Gibson's view, there was no representation prior to the representation of the affordance. And so, you know, it's not really, in my view, a very complete theory of perception. It's not a satisfying theory of perception. And I find information processing explanations much more plausible. So what worries me about a theory like Millikan's for perceptual representations is that it doesn't give you the kind of representations that are needed for information processing explanations. Now, if you know, if that's not the right approach to take, if you really need a more Gibsonian approach as opposed to an information processing approach, then that's a different discussion, right? So that, and I'm premising my discussion on this information processing approach being the most promising approach we have at the moment.
There's a number of problems raised for naturalizing semantics that you go through in the book. I think you have them divided into six. And a lot of them, they're basically, how does this theory give us determinate enough content? And some people put this in terms of a disjunction problem, and others put it in terms of, you know, if you have two co-occurring properties or properties that come at the same time in some way necessarily, or perhaps within the creature's environment. And then there are also problems about if you're going to have a causal informational element to your theory, then there's what you call the stopping problem, which is, you know, if you know, given that you have various steps along any causal chain from some distal object to the representational system, and, you know, why should the content be determined by what's at the end of that causal chain rather than some intermediate step? So you go through all of these, and you elaborate the basic CT account in order to account for some of them. But maybe you could, just to give us a flavor of how CT addresses at least some of the, you know, at least one of the initial problems that are raised for this type of account in terms of the determinacy or the problem of indeterminacy of the content that these types of theories deliver.
Yeah, thanks. So I, as you say, I discussed six indeterminacy challenges for the theory, but some of them are pretty straightforwardly answered by CT. And really the work is involved justifying the fact that you can have a causal theory of reference in combination with teleosemantics. So Fodor raised his version of the indeterminacy problem that he called the disjunction problem in relation to this notorious case of the frog. And he imagines a situation where the frog, I think, as he tells it, the frog only eats flies, and flies are always small, dark moving dots in the environment in which the frog evolved. And all small moving dots are also flies in this environment. So they always co-occur. And he says, look, if you're giving a teleosemantic theory, you have this problem that if it's adaptive to snap out your tongue in the presence of something small, dark, and moving, it's equally adaptive to snap out your tongue at a fly and vice versa. So, you know, how does Darwin, so to speak, distinguish between these two kinds of cases? But, of course, Fodor didn't think it was a problem for his own causal theory of content. And once you have a causal theory of reference combined with teleosemantics, it's not a problem for that kind of teleosemantics, because causal relations are property sensitive, right? So, you know, I remind people of this nice example from Fred Dretske, where he talks about a soprano singer singing a song, and her singing shatters a glass. And as Fred points out, the shattering of the glass is not caused by the meaning of the words that she sang. It's caused by something, you know, some other property of the singing, the the frequency or some sort of physical property of the singing. And so you have an event that has a lot of different properties, and it's causing another event, the shattering of the glass. And some of the properties of the cause are relevant to the shattering and some aren't. And that's what I mean when I say causation is property sensitive. So you can have a situation where, okay, suppose, you know, flies always co-occurred with small, dark, moving things. In the environment in which the frog evolved, and Fodor is absolutely right, if it's adaptive to snap in the presence of one, it's equally adaptive to snap in the presence of the other. But it doesn't mean that the frog was ever snapping in response to, say, the flyhood of the visual target, it being a fly, or in response to its nutritional properties. It can snap in response to it being small, dark, and moving, say, without snapping in response to, you know, it having these other properties. And so, you know, putting it together with the teleosemantics, you can say quite correctly, it was selected for responding to small, dark, moving things. It wasn't selected for responding to it being a fly or to being nutritious, because it never did respond to it. Can't respond here is just a causal notion. You know, it wasn't caused to respond in this way by the by it being a fly or by it being a nutritious, not in the relevant sense in which I'm using it in when I talk about the response functions.
So there are other problems, obviously, one being the relation of determinates to determinables, right? Often, you know, red as opposed to color. I don't know what other examples come to mind. Maybe a species genus is very similar. And there the idea is just that, well, whenever you represent, let's just say a color like red, you are also representing a larger class of which it is a particular type, namely color. So in response to this type of problem, you know, for the determinacy of content, you introduce the third element of your theory, which is a type of isomorphism, or as you put it, second order similarity element to the theory. So could you explain a bit about this particular problem, and then the way you elaborate the original theory in order to respond to it?
Yeah, thanks. I do think that CT on its own goes some of the way toward dealing with this. I think that some process can be responding to the redness of an object as opposed specifically to its being scarlet or its being coloured. So I think that CT doesn't, it's not completely hopeless by any means in the face of this kind of issue, but I think that once you introduce the idea of second order similarity, you can give a more fully fleshed out answer to that kind of problem. And so the idea of second order similarity, the easiest example I could think of in relation to this was this example of when you go into a clinic. Say you go into a clinic and you have a back problem, and the doctor says to you, give me a number from 1 to 10. 1 is no pain and 10 is the worst imaginable. And you know what to do. I mean, you might hate having to do it, but you know what you're supposed to do. And one of the aspects of that kind of representation is that you're being given a sort of a similarity space, so to speak, of representing elements. And you're also told what the relevant spaces for the things that you can represent. So you're given a sort of range of numbers, and you're told these should be used to represent a range of pain intensities. And you're being asked to pick the number that's analogous to the pain in the sense that it has this sort of analogous relations to the other numbers. as your pain has to the other pains. And this is a notion of second-order similarity. There's not much in common between the number six and a specific pain outside of this system. But within the system, you can see that they have analogous places within their respective similarity spaces. And different similarity spaces can allow for more or less resolution. So you can have very crude similarity spaces that don't allow for a lot of resolution, and you can have very fine-grained ones. And I think that once you introduce second-order similarity, you can give a more precise answer to the question of just how determinate is the content in this kind of case where you're talking about, does it represent scarlet, does it represent red, does it represent color, and so on. So it's partly for that reason that I introduce it, but it's also partly because I think it makes the teleosemantic theory more robust in the face of kind of cases that are similar to Hume's missing shade of blue, and take into account the fact that some of the development of our sensory perceptual system is going to be normal but idiosyncratic, in the sense that one person's sensory perceptual system, even if it's normal, won't be exactly calibrated the same as somebody else's. And so I think the kind of missing shade of blue kind of case, the sort of missing content kind of case, becomes more of a real problem when you take that on board. And I think it's it makes teleosemantics more robust in the sense that with a second order similarity system of representation, the contents of the representations get assigned en masse. You don't need a selection history, a specific, or, you know, in the case of intentional systems, you don't need a specific specification for each individual representation. It's kind of assigned en masse. So the doctor, for example, doesn't have to tell you, you know, use one for this, use two for this, use three for that, use four for that. The doctor just has to say, look, here's the range, 1 to 10. Here's the way it's oriented to pain intensities. A 1 is no pain, and 10 is the worst imaginable agony. And you do the rest. She doesn't have to explain to you the role of the number 6. You can figure it out from there. And I think that similarly with representations being assigned by the brain during development, that you could have a sort of more spotty selection history assigning the contents because of this phenomenon of their contents being assigned en masse rather than one by one.
We're starting to run out of time here, so I do want to get to the stopping problem, which you also spend a bit of time on, right? This idea that you have a causal chain, and what makes one step in that causal chain the content rather than another. Could you say a bit about how you solve that problem?
Well, I hope I solve that problem, but I guess that's the part of the book that I go back and forth on. Yeah, so I don't think CT solves that problem. I think that's pretty clear. The problem it's most obvious in the case of a causal theory of reference, because you've always got causal chains and you've always got more than one cause of representation being produced. But it does occur for other theories of content as well. You can make it, you know, you have to frame it slightly differently, but the problem arises for other versions of teleosemantics and other theories of content as well. But it's very vivid in the case of a causal theory of reference for perceptual representations. You know, you're looking at a cow and light comes reflected from the cow onto your retinal image and so on, and why is the content the cow rather than something else along this causal chain? And That's a sort of conceptualized perception, a perception that's being imbued with a sort of some conceptual content where you see something as a cow. So I don't try to deal with that particular kind of case, but I do take on the problem as it concerns, you know, more non-conceptual representation, the kind of case that might arise with something, you know, like a toad or something, or, you know, some of the earlier visual representations that I discuss. And what I say there is that I think at that point you need to add a further principle. And it's important to understand that you've only got candidate contents at this point that have already sort of survived the rest of the theory. You can't kind of use this principle on its own. It has to be added in and used to discriminate among the contents that still remain as candidate contents. But I say, yeah, look, it's true that if the visual system, if certain processes in the visual system are selected to respond to light, because that's a means of responding to things like cows and colors and so on, then it really is selected to respond to both. You know, you can't have one without the other. You know, if it's selected to respond to light because that's a means to respond to cows, etc., then it really is selected to respond to both. And so CT alone does not give you that distal content there. But I say that, I point out just that there's an asymmetry in the information relation, which I treat as a causal relation. And I point out that in some cases, a system is selected to respond to something only because it's a means to respond to other things and not vice versa. So, you know, the visual system is selected to respond to light because it's a means of responding to things like, you know, visual targets in worm-like motion, as opposed to, you know, a visual system is not selected to respond to its, you know, to light for its own sake. It's selected to respond to items that reflect light. And so it's an appeal to this asymmetry.
Well, we're almost out of time, and I did want to sort of urge you or press you a little bit to speculate about, you mentioned at the beginning that there were some chapters that you had written about conceptual content that you cut out. And one of the questions that I had was how this basic theory, you know, how you might speculate as to how this might be the start of a theory of content for thought, right, for conceptual contents. And maybe this is part of, like, where you're going next. I don't know. So could you maybe speculate a bit about what, you know, how you think someone who is interested in using this to go on to explain thought content, how that story just might go?
I can try. Yeah, I think that people could go in a number of different directions. And so I think that you could take the attitude, some people might take the attitude that you just need a completely different independent theory for concepts. They might think that the content of concepts, you know, the concepts too have original intentionality. So maybe you need different theories for non-conceptual representations and for conceptual representations, and maybe they need to be completely independent. I strongly suspect that that's not true. I suspect that it's good to start a theory of concepts being able to assume that you've already got a theory of the content of non-conceptual representations and that you can take that for granted and that you can use as part of your resources in trying to develop your theory of content all of these non-conceptual representations. Now, exactly how you go about doing that would be nice if I could give you an answer to that. So my next move in relation to thinking about this is again, I like to break it down. I like to try to think, what are the kind of simplest cases from here on? And I would like to, you know, I'm thinking about what kind of conceptual repertoire, if any, some would want to add, can a creature have if it's a non-linguistic creature? You know, what role does language play in concept acquisition for us, and what kind of concepts could non-linguistic creatures possess? Because I think that would be the next relatively simple step. And of course, people use the word concept in so many different ways. And so, I'm not sure how that will be understood by different people. But I do think that non-linguistic creatures can possess some concepts, at least what I think Jesse Prince calls them appearance concepts, where you're trying to track and store a record, maybe a statistical record of the features of certain types of items in your environment. And so I'd like to, you know, I think that that step is relatively easy. And then beyond that is a whole range of other kinds of concepts that really need to be considered quite separately. Toward the end of Jerry Fodor's and Zenon Pilishin's recent book, they talk about how, you know, we have to sort of treat these different categories of concepts differently. And they don't tell you how to treat them, but they claim that you need to treat them differently. And I think that that's right. I think that you need to then divide and conquer. You need to take it slowly and look at the different kinds of concepts there are. And think about some of them being closer to original intentionality than others.
Okay, well, we're out of time, and you've been very generous with your time. And I'd like to end with a question. You know, what is on the horizon for you? Are you actually taking this next step, or are you turning to other topics? What are you working on?
Yeah, I'm pretty single-minded. I think I can't let go of the general problem of intentionality, and do want to put some of the material I have on concepts together with more extended treatment of other parts of it. So, you know, up until now, I've been doing bits and pieces that, you know, had to be done after getting the book off. But yeah, that would be what I would be aiming to do.
Excellent. Well, again, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with New Books in Philosophy, and I wish you luck with the work in progress, and I look forward to seeing it.
Thank you so much, Carrie. It was really good to be here.
You've been listening to my interview with Karen Neander, who is professor of philosophy at Duke University. We've been talking about her new book, A Mark of the Mental, in Defense of Informational Teleosemantics, which is just out from the MIT Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoy the podcast, and thanks again for listening.